Everyone, welcome back to the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. It is your host, Sarah and Lori. And today we have a very fun, very spicy guest episode. Before we get into it, though, just want to thank a few of our newest Patreon folks. Drew and Chelsea, your support means the world to us. Thank you so much for your love and devotion and belief in us. No, we really appreciate you guys, and thank you for making this possible for us. Today, we have our friend Leslie here, who guys, I think this could be the spiciest episode of all. And the thing that Leslie doesn't know that I figured I would just like wait until we hit record so we could see like her authentic response to this is this touches, and Lori knows this, very close to home on my divorce and the reason for my divorce.
It's my fault because I was like, why don't you bring this up? And then the next time I talked to you, you were divorced. But anyways, we'll get into that.
I set a boundary of like, eventually I have to stop fucking talking about my divorce, but this is not the episode to stop. So, guys, Leslie, welcome.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here. I'm 30 years old, millennial, definitely. I got my borderline diagnosis about 5 years ago, and it took me probably about 3 years after getting the official diagnosis to like really embrace it and internalize it and start doing the work specifically around borderline, you know, with DBT and other things like that. So I was super thrilled, when you suggested me coming onto the podcast. I am not an expert on polyamory by any means, but I actually have been practicing basically I consider myself, ambiamorous, or polyflexible. People like those, you know, different terms. So I can do monogamy. I can do mono-poly relationships and then, you know, just, you know, poly, straight, you know, generic poly.
So for the listeners that may not know what that is, because I know for a fact my dad has no idea what you're talking about right now.
Dean shout out is back.
So if you could please explain to my poor father what polyamory is and all of the other words that you explained. Yes,
absolutely. I am more than happy. My nickname in grade school was the Human Dictionary. So this is where I shine. So polyamory, poly, multiple, amory, love, in a really basic, you know, level, it's multiple loves. Nowadays, most people sort of see it, a lot of people call it ethical non-monogamy. So it kind of is a catch-all for a lot of different relationship styles and types. And so that's why I was saying things like, you know, poly, mono. And so, you know, would be like one partner is monogamous and the other partner is, you know, polyamorous. So polyflexible, like I mentioned, that's where, like I was saying, you can have, I've been in monogamous relationships and I've been in polyamorous relationships and I've been very happy in both. Ambiamorous is just sort of like a synonym for that as well. I think that's all the terms. Did I cover them?
I think so. Yeah, that's super helpful. I know not everybody will know what you're talking about. And it'll be really helpful for them.
No, by all means. Yeah.
Okay. I have a question though. So this kind of is, this for me feels very like, kind of the ENM to queer. Like at some point it's like, are we bi? Are we pan? Are we like, we're just queer. We're just queer. Right. Yeah. So like as a non-monogamy is kind of just that, like we're just queer of non-monogamous relationships.
Very similar. Totally. Yeah.
Okay.
I got my degree up in Berkeley, California, and I lived in the Bay Area for about 5 years after I graduated from college as well. So that's really where I got exposed to polyamory first. And like, it was a really like beautiful, amazing, cool journey. This was like in the heyday when like the dating apps were free and like there were none to like minimal ads still. OkCupid was popping off. And so it was... It was really easy, honestly, to meet a lot of people. And I didn't realize at the time that I obviously have a big chunk of childhood trauma. I mean, maybe not obviously, but, you know, borderline. And so what I didn't realize is that when I graduated from college, probably a content warning or a trigger warning here for suicide. I tried to kill myself after I graduated college, and that ended up with a 72-hour hold. That sort of started a whole new era of traumatization in my life. Where I was really, once I was an adult, I was really sort of out on my own and doing, you know, I was sort of going through the motions of my trauma without having enough knowledge to really see what I was doing to myself. And so while I was practicing polyamory, I was also doing a lot of like casual sex that was very dangerous, mixing lots of various substances, you know, putting myself in positions where I was not able to consent. And so I like had a bit of a rubber band reaction after that, where I was like, no, poly is, that's harmful. I did that because I hated myself. I did that, you know? And so I had a monogamous relationship end in February of this year. And so I took, you know, a few months to really process that, because it was rough, obviously. And then I decided to come back to it. And that's when Sarah and I had the conversation, and she was like, hey, let's talk about it.
Yeah. So anyone who's listening who has borderline personality disorder, you know, it shows up the most in our interpersonal relationships most often. I'm going to argue that if it doesn't show up in your relationships more often than anything else, you were misdiagnosed, but,
could be friendships though. It doesn't have to be
interpersonal relationships.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Just to clarify.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Lori, just because you and Aaron are stable does not mean other people are stable. Okay. Stop. So like for me, it's like my initial reaction, even though I've absolutely wanted to practice this in my life, and I imagine what other people's initial reactions are as well, is like, fuck, it's so hard just doing it with one person with my symptoms, let alone how do you do it with 2, 3, 4, multiple, and like not lie about it. Right. Cause like, I'm not going to say I've practiced monogamy.
That's the
I'm also ethical. I'm also not going to say I practice ethical non-monogamy, right? So it's the honesty around it and being willing to have those uncomfortable conversations that I think is really what prompted me to be like, yo, come talk about this.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And what I've noticed coming back to polyamory this time around, after having a few very serious monogamous relationships really just kick me in the ass. I'm going to like say something kind of controversial here. It's a lot easier to hide from yourself in a monogamous relationship. It is a lot easier to hide from yourself. Because there is all that pressure on that one partner, it's just too easy really to like sort of put the responsibility of the problems you're experiencing on the relationship, because it's the context that you're experiencing them in. Right. And with polyamory, what I have noticed, it's a lot easier for me to notice in my polyamorous relationships. It's a lot easier for me to notice what I'm really taking with me into my interactions with my polyamorous partners. It's a lot easier to see, and you know, with trauma, when you are somebody who struggles with like complex PTSD or borderline. Can I get kind of nerdy? Is it okay if I get kind of nerdy?
Yes, 100%.
For sure. Okay, cool. So neuroception is a concept that I'm very fond of when talking about trauma and borderline. And so that's basically just your sort of your subcortical, your subconscious brain's ability to sense your environment around you and basically just sift all of the stimuli that's coming into you for threat. And then we've got a backlog of all of our experiences that we've had and our memories and our interactions, our interpersonal relationships. And so we are constantly checking that stimuli that's coming into us from the environment against our past and saying, was that scary? Did that hurt me? Do I still hold that? Or is this safe? Can I, you know, stay in my sort of well-regulated state?
Can we just say like TED Talk it up, dude? Like that was such a beautiful description. Lori, was that not so beautiful?
It really was.
Yeah. Where that's going to be like our clip for social, because that was stunning.
Cool. Awesome. I'm glad you guys think so. I'm super, super passionate about it. So yeah. So what I notice in my polyamorous relationships is, because you can sort of compare your experiences with partners and not compare in a way of like, oh, this one is better than that one, because that's not at all what polyamory is about. Like if you're dating multiple people in hopes of finding the one or the best, that's not really polyamory. That's, I don't know. Yeah. That's
playing the field or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And this, that brings up like that there's not this really harsh delineation between monogamy and polyamory necessarily. Right. Like I'm somebody who's polyflexible. Right. So I'm somebody who is generally kind of monogamous in my poly relationships. Like I have an anchor partner and that's basically just like some people, not everybody likes, well, again, not everybody likes to have a hierarchy for their partners, but some people do have a nesting partner or an anchor partner, they'll call it, where that's sort of their main, or they have the strongest connection, or they fulfill, or that partner helps them fulfill most, you know, the most of their emotional needs or whatnot. I usually have, you know, one partner like that. And then I'll have sort of these orbiting partners that will come back in every once in a while. And, you know, it's nice to like, reconnect and, you know, see those people. And it's nice not to have to worry about feeling guilty for my own feelings, because that's a really gnarly trigger for the borderline. And that's where it ties back in. Is that feeling of guilt or shame, or of feeling like I need to calculate my actions so that my partner won't get mad at me or won't leave me. I mean, that is just insanely triggering for my borderline. And that is one of the reasons why monogamy has not worked out well for me in the past with my particular, you know, neurotype or whatever. So yeah, we were talking about neuroception. That's right. Okay. So when you're with a new partner, for instance, and you're on a date and you're, you know, neuroception is going like crazy because this is like a high stakes sort of situation, especially for us borderlines. If we're like thinking we're, you know, sort of, I don't know if you guys feel like you're sort of interviewing a new favorite person when you're on a first date, but I can't help but sort of feel that way no matter what. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe, I don't know.
I don't have that experience, but I had such a painful breakup with an FP like 6 years ago that I haven't had one since, other than my dog. So like, and I like maintaining those hard boundaries and not having an FP, but I don't think that's normal. Although I found out I'm Lori's FP and I do consent, and I am giving it back to her. So maybe I do now, but I don't,
also, we haven't really talked a lot since I said that to you. So now my rejection.
Like, no, is your rejection sensitivity going off? Well, let's have a conversation about my life the last few weeks, because it's not you, it's me, I promise. But no, I actually like, I don't know if it, so, okay. I got divorced, right? Separated, whatever. Separated in October of last year. Dated, had a lot of sex. I went on a lot of dates, right? And never once did I feel like I was like looking for the one. I definitely was like truly infatuated with people. Lori knows I was very, very infatuated, but I wasn't catching myself be like the one necessarily until I met my current boyfriend. And then it was like right away. So I don't, Lori, were you like that? Were you looking for your FP each go around?
So many go arounds. I don't think I was like looking for it. And I don't know if I ever really found it either. Like I've definitely had situations where like I've gone home with somebody and then I'm, you know, on the train home that night or the next morning telling my friends, like, oh my God, I met my future husband, and like never talked to them again. You know what I mean? But I don't think that was necessarily my experience. But what I find so interesting about like this whole concept of polyamory is that you're saying, for you at least, it helps with your kind of like attachment. Whereas for me, that's my concern, right? Is like, I would totally be cool with like the physical parts of all of this, but it would be the emotional that would be like really stressful for me. So it's just so interesting.
Okay. I have to say, this is my ideal scenario would be if I get to practice polyamory, but my partner does not, right? And that's when you're like, that's not ethical non-monogamy.
No, that would be a monopoly relationship.
If that works for the other
person. It's consensual. Yeah, exactly.
But like, I could see how it would be actually very helpful to the part of me that emotionally asks for a lot from other partners to be able to like spread out meeting my needs across multiple. Right. But then there's also this question of like, how much self-soothing am I doing also? And so then it's that constant checking in of like, am I using my skills versus am I using people versus like what I'm doing?
Totally. I think that that's a really, really good point. And what I have noticed is that like a lot of people will think like, if you're polyamorous, then like you're just swimming in partners and like, you're just dating 5 zillion people all the time. And that is very much not my experience either. The other reason why I feel like I sort of had more of an orientation towards like finding like a primary or like a favorite person is, because I don't do casual relationships are much more different for me to do polyamorously than like maybe more sort of like relational connections, you know, where you're really getting to know each other on like a deeper level. And my default when I interact with people, I drop down to that immediately. It doesn't matter who you are. Like you could be a stranger at the bar. We're going to get deep.
Me too. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And there's just really not, you know, if I was going to change that, I would have to change who I am. And so what I find when I'm dating polyamorously is like, it's hard to find partners that like multiple partners that are cool with providing that level of support. And so rather what I've noticed this go around is that rather than settling for these low level connections, which is what I was doing when I was casually dating in my early 20s, right? I was accepting much less investment than I really wanted. And I just figured if I stack enough of those up, it'll, you know, it'll add up. And so this time around, what I'm seeing is I recently broke it off with a partner that I absolutely adored. Things were going so well. And like it, we, you know, it was the early dating stage and, you know, things were kind of amorphous and, you know, I would suspect that he is very avoidantly attached. And so with my disorganized attachment, usually if I'm with somebody who's more avoidant, I'll tend towards a more anxious style or anxious ambivalent, rather than anxious avoidant. Because with disorganized, you get characteristics of both of the insecure types.
You won the lottery. Like,
Yeah. And that's another thing about polyamory that I love is I wouldn't have discovered that about myself without having multiple relationships in tandem. I mean, you really do have to be in it at the same time because it's totally good to compare past relationships to present ones, you know, but it's very different to have that embodied experience like within the literal same day, you know, because sometimes there are days when I do see multiple partners in one day, you know.
I've done that without being polyamorous. So
yeah,
she has. And her mom noticed.
Yeah. I'm like, so I just went from the hotel with this guy back to this guy's house. What was his name? Yeah.
Yeah.
Not, I think not E&M. Yeah. I think I'm perpetuating the stigma that has made it like dangerous for polyamorous people through this humor though. Right. Like, obviously I don't mean this, but I think there is very much a, like stigma from people who practice monogamy or can't understand the desire to practice polyamory, that it's this like slutty or needy or want your cake and eat it too kind of identity. And it's when you think about it from a needs-based perspective, like I probably could be managing my life in a different or better way if I could practice E&M.
It's funny that you say that, Sarah, because I find at least like, obviously there's generational issues here, like very different for like our parents' age or whatever, but I find.
If you told your parents, like if you brought two people home to Christmas, can you imagine?
Actually, I have a friend of a friend who I know decently well that's in a throuple right now with kids. And they're doing that, and it's really interesting. But anyways, unfortunately, they don't have BPD as far as I know, so it doesn't make sense for them to be on the podcast, but if only I could get them that diagnosis. But like for the majority of my friends, I think most of us are going into like, are either in a marriage or going into marriages knowing full well that like, this is not the last person we're going to sleep with. And like, I don't think that that would have been the case.
I did not have that experience.
But like, seriously, I mean, maybe my friends are just freaks. Like, I mean, like it's probably true, but like, most of my friends are not like committed to this like whole like concept of monogamy forever. It's just like, for right now, this is what we want, and that may change. And so it's funny, Sarah, that you think that there's like a lot of shame around that, because
that is so contradictory to my experience. Like, not a single one of my friends is practicing any form of polyamory or non-monogamy that I know of. And none of my friends who are married or are engaged or just recently got married have indicated at all that they have a desire to be with anyone outside of their marriage. Like, not a single one. And like, for me, I went into my marriage knowing full well this was the last person I would kiss for the rest of my life. Like, that was my plan and intention. That couldn't have been farther from the truth, but like, I didn't know that, right? That wasn't my plan. So I don't, maybe it's a Canada thing. Y'all are freaks.
So it's funny you bring that up, actually, because the person that I sort of learned the most about polyamory from was a married woman. So she's trans, and I met her, you know, pre-transition. And so that we first started dating off of OkCupid like that. And then, you know, she was married at the time. Her company was bought by a very famous other company, coffee company. She's also started a couple of other different like coffee shops and stuff. So anyway, so I learned a lot about polyamory from her. And basically it was a very similar situation where like her and her wife, I think they were probably two of like the only really queer kids in their town. And, you know, they sort of shortly before my former partner transitioned, they had decided to open up the marriage, you know, do a polyamorous or an open marriage. And it was really, really cool because this partner, she was older. She's got to be like 8 years older than me, probably. Yeah. So I was like 22 at the time, and she was probably like my age now, 30. Yeah. And so she was a combination of being extremely experienced in kink, which I am very fond of, just goes with the whole bisexual polyamorous, you know, gift basket. So she taught me a lot about that, but she was also sort of very new to polyamory as well. So in a lot of ways, I got to learn a lot of stuff, you know, with her in that way. And so that to this day is like literally one of the most special relationships I have ever had. And I think that the fact that I had such a positive experience with her, and she was really gentle with me and very, you know, I was, oh gosh, I'm like having flashbacks. I was with a really terrible partner, and she was very, very good about me suffering side effects of narcissistic abuse because of that. So yeah. Yeah, no, she's, I think because I had such a positive experience with that partner, I was able to try it, you know, again, and then to like, yeah.
Was it scary for you the first time? Like, did you worry about your BPD kind of like flaring up and getting really jealous or getting really attached or anything?
I mentioned that I had recently cut things off with a partner where things were going really well. I learned a hard lesson with this one. So like I said, he's very avoidantly attached. And so I noticed I popped into a dissociative episode. After a couple of weeks of hanging out, we got into a discussion about, you know, politics or something. And we, you know, like fundamentally it was one of those stupid arguments where it's like, fundamentally you agree, but like, you just can't, like, you know, like you're just arguing because you're triggered, you know, you're not talking about logic anymore. And so I popped into a dissociative episode, and that happened again. And then, you know, by then my system was so primed that this person was, going to trigger me, that I did end up splitting. And I was just like, you know, I asked about like what the feelings were like, you know, I don't want monogamy, but do you have romantic feelings versus platonic feelings for me? And he's so avoidant with his emotions. And I don't mean to like trash him, but I've been thinking about it a lot lately, that that was such a threat that he couldn't even like, he couldn't even explain, like, that was too much. And so he sort of, again, it just fed into that negative cycle that happens when two people, you know, are triggered with each other. So yes, that definitely happens. It's not like I definitely am not immune to splitting. I've definitely gone out on dates where I've like literally just been dumped. So that's another thing that happens. That's a fun, but you know, like if you're in a polyamorous relationship with all polyamorous people, or at least polyflexible people, then like my partner, you know, who I had the date with right after I got dumped was super cool. He's like, that sucks. Let's drink. Let's have a good time. You know? So that was, again, that's one of those things where it's like, I didn't have to hide myself on that date. I didn't have to like pretend that I hadn't just been fucking dumped, you know, by, you know, somebody that I really cared about. And I didn't have to worry about reprisal from a partner who is jealous or scared, or feeling threatened. So there's a lot of give and take in that respect. Yeah, it's a really good question. I know a lot of people, like one of the things that I struggle with the most is like this idea of, well, okay, so you're polyamorous and you're both dating multiple people. What happens when one of you or both of you gets a new partner? You know, you get a brand new, shiny, you know, exciting partner. And that's one of the amazing things about polyamory is you get to have the benefits of long-term relationships and new relationships, if, you know, if that's how you practice it. But the fear is often, you know, and this is understandable. Well, what if they're better than me? What if they like them more than me? How come they're doing other stuff with that partner that they don't do with me? And this is where you really have to dig into why you are practicing polyamory. And
can I just say, I just got physically, like, I felt that like physical guttural, like I want to throw up response to that, right? Like that's how primed we are to feel that way. It's hard for me to even identify if I truly feel like that, like, oh, would they like someone more than me? Why would they do? Or if that's just what society taught me. I don't know. Either way, I'm like,
right. It's horrifying. It's terrifying. This idea of sort of being supplanted in the heart of somebody that you love, you know, especially for borderlines where even more than other folks, we need help with our self-regulation. So we, you know, I mean, I think that it's probably pretty easy to say that we do rely on our partners a little bit more than the average bear, you know, and that's just part of living with the condition. And so that goes back to picking partners carefully, you know, like what I learned from that experience with this partner recently that I ended things with is, okay, this is not somebody that I can have safe conflict with. This is not somebody who is going to respect me and, you know, maintain their respect for me while they're triggered. And that is not okay. That is not behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, I may have sort of jumped the gun and I may have, but asking for clarification is no reason to bite someone's head off. And if you can't recognize that you're speaking from a, you know, a triggered place, then there's not, you know, that's sort of that's the first step to the work. And I can't do that work for him.
I love that concept of like safe conflict, right? Because that's the thing is, relationships shouldn't not have conflict. It just needs to be where you're able to have that conversation or that argument or whatever and kind of get to the other side without holding it against people.
Totally.
And I didn't even realize that was possible until Lori and Aaron talked to me about it, and it was incredibly triggering to me. But then this partnership that I'm in now, and actually it's, so you said something that is, Lori, I haven't talked to you for a few weeks. I haven't told you this. I found out that my ex-wife has a new partner.
How did you not tell me? Okay. My favorite person is triggering me. No, I'm just kidding.
I found out on my 28th birthday, and I had a pretty, the most significant self-harm event I've ever had in my life. And, it was really, really, really painful. And my partner now, is the one who responded, and he was obviously watching me be devastated and heartbroken that I just found out that my ex-wife has a new partner while he's been dating me for 5 months. Right. So like this very clear acknowledgement of like, you love me and you love someone else. And it's true. He knows that I love him and I love someone else, even though I'm not in a relationship with my ex-wife.
That's such a good example.
Well, it was like, he was able to say to me, Sarah, you're like, Tori doesn't love this new person more than she loves you. She loves her differently and she will love her differently. And Tori will never love anyone more than she loves you. I'll never love you more than I loved anyone else. I'll just love you differently than I've loved other people. And he was able to just like literally hold me and be like, we made it. You're alive. It's okay. We've got it. And it was so profound for me that he could respond to a very traumatic situation in that way. That was like my own conflict about someone else. And he literally was like, it makes me sad to think that you feel like that when you still have me. And that was the only part of it that was like his response. He wasn't angry. He wasn't jealous. He just said, this makes me sad. Like, and I'm like, people can do this. People can do this. What?
Yeah, no, I think that it's not really about like finding somebody who will meet your emotional needs for you. It's about having somebody who will help you meet those emotional needs. And that's what he was doing in that moment. You know, he wasn't taking responsibility for your feelings. He wasn't, you know, stressed. He wasn't internalizing it. He was just helping you meet whatever emotional need you had in that moment. And that's like, that's companionship. That's partnership in my mind. You know,
it's beautiful. Yeah. That's a beautiful example, Sarah.
Well, it's just like, that is what I was thinking about when you said, I can't remember exactly what you said, but they can't, what was the thing, Lori? They can't do how, what, say it again, Leslie, say it again.
Which one?
I don't remember.
About how like,
conflict, how they respond in conflict.
Oh, safe conflict or
yes.
Secure conflict or yeah. Safe conflict. Yeah. There we go. That's a really, really great example too of how you can have these sort of polyamorous phenomenon within monogamous relationships.
Yes.
Lori, did you see what I just did?
Wow, that's a statement, and that is so true.
There goes our most downloads of any episode ever.
Fingers crossed, have me on again.
Holy shit, that's a concept. Wow, yeah, that is so true.
You know, I'm all about, you know, I was definitely, you know, because I have my degree in psychology and especially like my experience with, you know, having borderline, like I'm very much about a spectrum approach to like literally everything. my best friend is actually autistic. And so with autism, we have this concept of spiky profiles where people have like really high capacities in some areas and they have, you know, lower capacities in others. And I feel like every relationship is kind of like that. Like in every different configuration, you're with every different partner, you're going to have strengths and you're going to have things that you struggle with. And I mean, this is kind of a facile example, but like polyamory, it's a little bit like supercharging that process because you're sort of doing that on multiple different levels with multiple different people at the same time. And I try to steer away from talking like polyamory is like better than monogamy because it is absolutely not. It is 100% about the fit that is right for you and your partners, right? You know, and whatever makes you happiest, you know. So I try not to do that.
Well, and I'm sure there's tons of people with that are monogamous that are like, oh, that's so much better. You know, like it's literally, like you say, just about where you're at with that person and yourself and the moment. And like, that's why I like that, that polyflexible, right, is what you were calling it. Like, I kind of love that concept because it means, I think that that's what most people I know that I'm referring to as my friends, like are, right? Like none of us would identify as polyamorous, but I don't think any of us would necessarily identify with the concept of monogamy either.
Sure. Or you're not necessarily going to like cut off an opportunity with a partner who says that they are polyamorous per se. It's not like a hard deal breaker necessarily, or maybe it is, you know?
No, not at all. Actually, funny story about that. When Aaron asked me out the first time, I rejected him because I had a date with someone, and the guy that I was going on a date with actually was married. And like, it was totally like, he was like, you can call my wife and talk to her. Like, no problem. Like there's, you know what I mean? Like there's rules like we have together.
Ethical, yeah. Yeah.
And I was just like, this is so cool. And then I rejected Aaron for it.
That's so funny because I went on a first date with my boyfriend, Andrew, and I was like, not that interested in him. And he was like, I think canceled our date like twice. And he was just like, this bitch is a flake or whatever. But Lori knows I had been sad by some crazy human from the day before. And so I was like, fine, fuck it, I'll go on a date. But then on my way to the date, I was like setting up a hookup with a person who practices ethical non-monogamy afterwards. And I was like, I'll see you in an hour. This isn't going to last long. I never saw the poor guy. It was like a 9-hour date. So Lori and I had the opposite.
Oh, that's so funny. That's fantastic. And like a lot of relationships pass through that sort of liminal stage where like people are dating around, you know? And so like, again, like a lot of monogamous folks will have very short periods of, you know, dating behavior that looks a lot like polyamory.
Except people don't necessarily know about it, right? Like, I think that's the thing is like a lot of the time that's behind closed doors and people are lying about it. And I've never been one to lie about that. But I don't know if I'd call any of it ethical. You know,
I think it's how you I don't know. So, I'm a very much like, until we call the kettle black or whatever, we're not practicing monogamy. Until you say we're practicing monogamy, we're not. So I can't assume you are, and you can't assume I am.
Agreed.
Right. But Lori was like, Sarah, that's bullshit. You got to tell Andrew you're going on a date with someone else. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Nope, I'm not.
I don't remember that specific incident, but I feel like I've had this conversation with so many people that like, I think like in some ways when you have a strong enough emotional connection with somebody, yeah. it becomes kind of like, the issue is sometimes it's implied for people. And it's like, I'm very much like, unless you tell me I'm not allowed to, then I can do whatever I want. But I don't think that that's the case for everybody. So like,
the default in our culture is definitely monogamy too. So most folks are going to be, that's going to be the assumption.
Yeah. Although like you could argue with like Tinder and stuff, that's less the assumption now. Because like we've all been on dates and gone to the bathroom and swiped.
Duh.
And we know that that's
how they're getting you a beer.
Yeah. Right. Like, I mean, it's happened. Right. So,
God. Yeah. I miss swiping. I want to swipe. I don't want to date, but I want to swipe.
Me too.
You can find friends on Tinder now, apparently.
I don't need new friends. I have so many friends. I'm so busy.
There's so many friends.
I love them. And I don't need more, to be honest. You know,
I just need someone to tell me I'm pretty.
Straight up.
Dude, for real.
You're so pretty.
Yes. I send my nudes to my friends. Yeah.
Okay. So I want, I fucking always do this. It's the borderline in me, but not to make it about me, but to make it about me. So I want to run this by you because you have practiced this. So my marriage was sexless. I mean like way sexless, like no. Yeah. Way sexless. And it was very much, if there was any physical intimacy, it was like very mechanical, very methodical, like there was no emotion present. And it was like me just begging to be touched. Right. Okay. Anyways. So after multiple 3-month periods of no sex and me being very clear about like, I have to have some sort of physical intimacy if I'm going to stay in this marriage, I made a very clear decision after a long time of trying to do the work, marriage therapy, no, you get it, right? No feedback, nothing changing.
Oh yeah.
I made a decision and I said, like, I have been very clear with you since before we got married about what my needs have been, and you have not met them. I've given you all of the options. Like, I've tried all of the things and it's not resulting in what I need. And in order to stay in this marriage, we either have to open it up or we have to separate. And
Yeah.
So I didn't give her any options though. I was like, I already made this decision. Like there's no breathing room for me in this. You either have to try or you aren't, we can't be together. And, you know, she was really, really, really upset. And it was like, I have such compassion fatigue for you. Take your fucking upsetness elsewhere. Because like, I've been saying the same thing for years. Right.
When you get into a marriage with someone that's monogamous, I mean, that's really what you're taking on. You are taking on like, okay, so if we're going to be monogamous, there are certain needs that I can
responsibilities
here.
And
yeah.
People don't talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, this like, if we're monogamous, then this is literally the only place I can get sex or physical affection. And you know, you can't just withhold that wholesale.
No. And it got to a point where it was like, I need 7 to 10 minutes twice a month. Like I don't need any oral sex. I don't need any, like wearing of any devices. I just need a very physical mechanical action for 5 to 10 minutes twice a month, you know, right. 24 times a year. Like I'm asking for very little to maintain the marriage. So anyways, so I opened it up. Tori was not interested. But I had to feel some sort of desire. And, after I did have sex with someone, Tori like really, really felt like it was cheating. And, you know, that's fair. She's allowed to think that. To me, I didn't feel like it was cheating. I had been very clear for the entire process, but yeah. So I'm interested to hear your perspective, validate me or invalidate me. I don't care, but I want to know the perspective.
It's all about consent and ethics, right? And like, again, setting those boundaries. And like a lot of the time for a lot of folks, because like what, 2/3 of the population is insecurely attached or whatnot. We don't always take people at their word, right? So like for somebody who's used to communicating in like very passive or like not very direct ways, like, it's really easy, I think, for them to just sort of in their head say like, okay, well, that's what they're saying, but it's not actually going to end up working out that way. And then when the rubber hits the road and it does work out that way, their reaction, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, yes, we can do that. And it's another thing to not have your emotional reaction in the moment. but no, I don't think that sounds like cheating at all. I mean, you were very clear. You had voiced your needs. You'd given, like, you had ratcheted up the options for like a long period of time, man. Yeah, no. I think you were very ethical in that one. Validate. You are validated.
I feel the opposite. You.
Lori feels the opposite. Yeah, and you can.
Oh, okay, that's valid.
And not because I think what you did was wrong.
She's never told me she feels the opposite. This is the first time I've heard.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't know you felt that way.
Well, no. I just mean like, well, you asked a very, very specific question here. So like in the way that you worded the question, I feel like unless the other person says like, yeah, okay, that's fine. Then it's not necessarily like consent to do that.
There was some, yeah, okay, that's fine. There was some, these are the rules. And then there was some, no, I don't like that anymore. And some backtracking. And it was like, I was already at this place of like, I am worthy of desire. You have been totally unwilling and uninterested to give me desire for years now. Like, I'm asking like for nothing basically.
Yeah. Let me be very, very clear here. I think you did the right thing.
Yeah.
And I would have done the same thing. I'm not 100% sure if I would have called that like ethically non-monogamous moment.
Oh, I don't think it's ethically non-monogamous. Mm-mm. I don't think that's ENM. I don't think it's ENM. I don't think it's cheating. I think it's somewhere in a spectrum of like, I was very clear and I had to make a choice for me to see what, you know, how it was going to play out. And to be honest, it played out in the best possible way. Cause like Tori wants a different life than the one I want. And I want someone who wants to be present with me. And we both got that.
Absolutely. And that's an example of when, like for some, like if you don't have the conversation before the wedding of like, hey, we're monogamous now, but at some
ding, point, ding, ding.
yeah, we may want to open this up, then it's going to be a very different mindset that the partners are going into with it for sure. Yeah. And like you were saying, Lori, you have like a lot of friends who have said, okay, we're monogamous now, but you know, maybe later on down the line, we'll open it up.
And even if that's just talk, right? Like nobody's holding anybody to that, but like, it's just to say that, you know what, like eventually this might get mundane or boring and I still love you to death. And I want to even just like talk to other people, right? Like,
yes. Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be physical. It's just, it's really interesting to me how many people in my life have that mentality, and it's mutual. And actually it's mostly driven by the woman, in which is not necessarily something that I think society would think is the case. And I don't know if that's your experience too.
Oh, I mean, I definitely think I've met more polyamorous women than polyamorous men for sure. And I think that it also speaks to one, the way that women are sort of socialized to spread out their sort of like we're very much socialized to be like social, you know, butterflies and to go and like make connections and more so than, you know, like assigned male at birth folks. So I think that that's part of it. Women also remain sexually flexible. Like, I think they get gayer as they get older. So I think that's, you know, I don't know if that's a statistic, but.
You're like, it is now. This is straight fact.
So I think that that might be a part of it as well. But I'm going to say another controversial, I'm going to get a little spicy. I think that the way that women and men interact, and we're talking obviously about heterosexual couples here, though these things can definitely rear their heads in same-sex relationships. So I think that there's, you know, if you looked at the data, you would probably find that there are a very large number of American men that are avoidantly attached. And that if you looked at the data, you know, of all the anxiously attached folks in, you know, the States, we'll say more of them would be women. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, like how we socialize, you know, folks and whatnot. And I think that with that anxious attachment, that really mirrors with the borderline, that real sort of anxiety around emotional validation and, you know, that fear of abandonment. And so it doesn't surprise me, honestly, that more women are poly than men. I would stand by that.
Well, also, can we just have it be said that, like, I don't know, you guys, I apologize if I offend anyone, but like, I think men are just like simpler. I don't know. Emotionally, it seems to me, after having dated both men and women, they require less emotional presence. And like,
they're socialized. Exactly. Totally.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like they won't pick up, like, men are less likely to pick up social cues, unless they're associated with anger or aggression. So that's a totally, totally good point that like, men are really taught to have this sort of front facing, like, I don't have needs. I'm a simple guy. I'm straightforward. I'm all logic. I don't have them, you know? And I think that with the avoidantly attached, that's actually a really good model for that, because what's really happening underneath that is a massive amount of contained anxiety. Right. And so it's literally like, I think that like, men are simpler because they're just dissociated. Like they're literally just, they've compartmentalized parts off, you know, whether they're toxically masculine or, you know, not. I think that all, you know, all folks, I like still don't know, like, I'm like, should I say assigned male at birth? Because I don't want to get into gender.
I know. Well, you know? And that's the thing I was thinking about that as well, is like, none of this is black and white.
No.
We all know that like gender isn't male or female, right? Like I would hope that the majority of our audience would get that we're saying this all like pretty, pretty like generically, where we know that that's not the case. But I do have to say something really hilarious, because I tried to just Google what percentage of people with BPD are polyamorous, because I thought that would be really interesting, because it's either going to be a really low number or a really high number, but apparently it auto-corrected. And I was very confused about why all I was getting was being polyamorous and Christian is not a sin. what does the Bible say about polyamory? And I was like, I don't think that this is what I Googled.
God, what does the Bible say about polyamory?
Okay, we're gonna have to do a new podcast. But well, I mean, there's like a whole polygamist religion in BC that's like been a big like Bountiful BC or whatever. He like went to jail. Anyways, what I meant was BPD, not God, because apparently
BPD are God. That is why it did that.
Clearly, there you go. I had autocorrect.
Duh.
It's trying to tell me something, apparently. Okay, there's no obvious answer. But just for...
I would argue it's probably higher.
I would think so too. But for stigma purposes, here's a helpful thing that just came up. Is polyamory a personality disorder?
Ooh, wow.
That's the first, like, you know how Google does like the like common questions or whatever. So like just for the record, like that goes to show what our society thinks about.
Sure. But I will say... For the changing identity part of BPD, it would be fucking cool to have like a like rad artist partner and then like a cool snowboarding partner and then like a fucking lawyer. Oh, a lawyer partner. Like, let me just meet all my identity needs, you know, across the spectrum of partners.
It wouldn't be so devastating when you lose a partner that way too, because I mean, obviously you shouldn't wrap up your whole identity in your partner, you know, but like for me, I mean, I just genuinely lose interest in like, I had a partner a while ago that I played Pokemon Go with and I was super into it and I loved it. And it was something that we did together. We went and took walks at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, and after we broke up, you literally could not pay me to download the app again. Like you know, and it's not that I don't enjoy the game. It just doesn't give me the dopamine that I need to be motivated to do it anymore. I also have ADHD, so that might play in there too, but yeah, totally. I agree.
So I have a question, and like this, honestly, I feel like we could talk for literally ever because this is so interesting and I'm sure we will get a lot of questions come in. So we will probably have you on again, but I do have a question that I know will be asked if I don't ask it. So do your partners know you have BPD, and what was that experience like if they do, telling them that, and if they don't, why not?
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Like the thought of having to come out with my BPD to multiple partners makes me just like, ugh. Okay. Yes.
That is an excellent question. I'm very much very much about having BPD on my paperwork as like a principle of the matter type of thing, even though I know it could expose me to stigma. I think that it's really important for folks to see us and see that, like, yes, your neighborhood barista has BPD. Yes, your coworker at the grocery store has BPD, you know, like
you're a therapist.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I am very straightforward about that. I also post a decent amount about it in my story on Instagram. And nowadays, I find most of my dates off of Instagram, to be honest. That's actually a really good way of sort of fielding partners and figuring out who I do decide to engage with further. Generally, if somebody is engaging with my content favorably around borderline, then like, yeah, I'll be more likely to give them, you know, or they'll see that I have a degree in psychology. And so they'll start chatting me up about that. And there are certain questions that I can ask them to sort of get a feel for what their level of like information and stigma is on different things.
Totally.
Yeah, but I'm very, very ardent about being upfront. I usually what I say is, you know, I have very big emotions. I tend to get attached to people very quickly. You know, and like in this instance with the partner where I ended things, you know, I had told him all of that from day one. And it was one of those situations, and this happens all the time, where I will be extremely upfront. Like we will be texting about borderline. We will be, you know, I will tell them about my symptoms. I will text them when I'm sobbing, you know? And again, like it's one thing to have that degree of separation on the internet or the phone. But oftentimes when I do meet up with people in real life, it's a deal breaker and they don't, you know it really.
But it sounds like your mentality there is kind of like, I'm putting this on the table. There's plenty of fish in the sea. If you're not cool with it, that's fine. I'm not like, I don't need to date you or Absolutely. Have sex with you or hang out or whatever. Cause yeah. I think the reason I ask the question is because it comes up in Super Feelers probably every single day, is like, how do I tell my new boyfriend? How do I tell the boy I like? How do I tell my mom? How do I tell my kids? And I know for some people that is like a terrifying experience. And I totally get that because I have been dumped for having BPD plenty of times, especially when you have this many personal dynamics going on. I think it would, at least in my head, obviously I'm not in that experience, but it would be even more important to have that conversation up front.
Yeah, it's sort of practice makes perfect, to be honest. I also come out to my friends, you know, as well, not just my romantic partners. So that's something also, it's really similar, honestly. The stakes are definitely higher with a romantic partner for sure. In my, you know, for me personally. But I really do feel like even when I tell people, even when I'm super upfront about like, hey, I have this disorder and it's really hard and it's chronic, and there will be times where you cannot help me and all you can do is hold me while I am sobbing and miserable. And you have to be able to do that. And one of the reasons why my last monogamous relationship ended is because my partner could not deal with feeling like a failure because he couldn't ameliorate my symptoms. And that was really something that he just couldn't handle. And so I think like when I'm telling people about the condition, I'm just really thinking about, all right, I want to give them the grace that I want to receive. You know, they're coming from this possibly, you know, sort of stigma informed position. You know, so I want to not have knee jerk reactions. You know, I want to sort of try and, you know, sort of really take in how they're responding before, you know, sort of engaging, you know, just basically having a degree of mindfulness in the conversation, which is always good.
Yeah. That is really essential.
Yeah.
Okay. My friend, we are kind of near our time. I'm just wondering, we are for sure bringing you back because
I would love to.
I almost feel like we should probably put like a Q&A out on polyamory and then have like another recording at some point in the next few months, because I imagine there's like quite a few of our listeners practicing or who want to practice, but are too afraid that their symptoms will like ruin the experience. Totally. Maybe you can provide some insight. So I will put a Q&A out. So for those of you who are listening, get some questions thought about this, because yeah, I think that would be really interesting and cool. But if there was like one thing you wanted people to know about borderline and polyamory, what would it be?
You don't have to give up anything because you have borderline. You just have to find a way to get what makes you happy in a way that doesn't hurt anyone else. And I personally have found that polyamory has been an amazing vehicle for me to do that personally. That's close as I can sum it up.
Yeah. And I see that for you, like in the way that you talk about your relationships being like from a very open, mindful, like harm reduction model, and a very like trauma informed, right? Like you're assessing the attachment style of your partners, like not because you're a psychology nerd in total, but because you understand that like your attachment has to match their attachment if it's going to be a neutral or positive experience. And we're always working towards not doing any more harm. So I think like that is a very cool reminder for me. I really like love that perspective.
Oh, thanks, Sarah. I'm so glad you guys had me on.
All right, my friend, thank you so, so, so much. And we will see you next time.
Yes. Thank you. Bye.
Hi friends, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. Lori and I are so grateful that you're here with us on this journey, and we can't wait to dive into more topics in the future with you all about borderline, and even have some more fun and exciting guests to join us on the podcast. If you really enjoyed this episode, we would love if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. We would also love to see you interact with us on social media and on our Patreon page. The links to that are included in the show notes, so check us out there. We would be incredibly honored to get to know you all as you get to know us and our recovery stories. We love you, and we'll see you next time.